Hi, Amy. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello, it's great to be here.
I'm so happy to have you here as a guest. I read your book, and it's a hard message to hear, but such an important message. And your book is called, let me show your book. It was an amazing, amazing read. I couldn't put it down. It's called Preyed Upon. Looks like this. And breaking free from therapist abuse. This is something that is, it was really new to me, the idea of abuse from a therapist. I think that what a lot of us thought is that, at least I did, I shouldn't say a lot of us, I thought that when you go to a therapist, you almost expect safety because they're trained. It didn't even occur to me that this type of thing could happen. The only thing I kind of thought that could happen was, personality clash or, maybe you have someone who's not really that attuned when they should be, and then you'll find another therapist. But what I've learned, because I had someone else on here also experience, therapy abuse from a narcissistic therapist. And what I learned was that it happens more often than we think. So your book was so impactful because you talk about how you really put your hope and trust in, I don't want to say the system, but in a therapist you trusted. And it takes a lot for those of us who've had trauma and we finally feel, okay, I'm going to make the step, I'm going to put my trust in someone because they're trained and they're skilled, and we feel sort of a safety net. We still feel nervous, but we feel kind of that behind us. Yeah, it's mind-blowing. But I want to ask you why you felt okay after this experience, you wanted to write the book and share.
I wrote the book originally because I wanted to understand what happened to me because I just didn't understand how, as an adult, I could be duped like this and that I could be manipulated. And I was really struggling to forgive myself. And so I wrote the book and kind of was able to see how the manipulation process unfolded. And then I realized there are so many other adult victims out there. I learned that the organization TEL, which is Therapy Exploitation Link Line, that they get 40 to 50,000 victims of adult therapist and clergy abuse every year to their website. That is an insane number. And that's just the number that have reached out. So I knew how I felt. The shame and being taken advantage of as an adult is crushing. And very little support. So I wanted to throw a lifeline to other adult victims to just know that they're not alone and know that what happened to them was not their fault.
You make a really good point because as I think we think that as adults, like we have compassion for children who have been abused or the elderly, you were telling me before, those vulnerable populations. And then we think, well, an adult, they have the wherewithal to be able to
Right.
make choices. But I think what we don't realize is that these are often vulnerable people who are going to therapy who have been abused. And when we start to even think, just like when you're triggered, you're brought back to that experience in your body, and it feels like it's happening now, and you feel childlike. So you can imagine when you go into a therapeutic space, even if you are a manager at work or you have all these other
Right.
position adult-like positions. When you talk about your childhood trauma, you're vulnerable again, you're childlike again. And so talking about the vulnerability, And that's the piece I don't think people understand. And hopefully you started to see that yourself.
Yeah, you know, studies, they've done some studies on therapist abuse, and there isn't a certain type of person that gets abused. And yes, those who go into therapy and remain guarded are less likely to be abused. They're also less likely to benefit from therapy.
Right.
Therapy works when we make the decision to trust and let our walls down and be vulnerable. And like you said, the emotions we're dealing with aren't typically adult emotions. They're childhood trauma emotions. So that adds another layer of vulnerability. And yeah, we blindly trust a lot of leaders, you know, in our world, assuming that they have a higher moral compass than we do.
Yep. Yeah. And again, you know, I have compassion because I'm thinking how hard it is to go for, you know, opening up that Pandora's box that many of us do not want to go there. But obviously, you must have been at a place, because that's what happens often, that brings us into reaching out for help and finally making that decision, that it's like it gets to the point where, like, I can't continue like this. I need to find support. And so maybe you can tell us a little bit about that time for you.
Yeah, I had my first abuse started when I was a child. And so I had dealt with depression. And as a result, because I couldn't get over the depression, self-hatred, because I thought I should be able to heal it. I should be able to, you know, cure it, fix it. And add on top of that, you know, parenting stresses, marital stresses. My marriage was very disconnected. And so, yes, I was just in a place of I'm tired. I'm tired of carrying this depression. I'm tired of feeling like there's something wrong with me. And that does kind of put you in a little bit of more of a desperate place. It's like, I've tried everything, you know? And so when I learned about this therapist and learned he was a leader in church and he was a psychiatrist, I thought, well, this has got to be the best of both worlds. And maybe this is going to be it. You know, maybe this is going to be kind of like my final attempt, and I'm going to be healed of all of this depression and, you know, once and for all. So.
Yeah, it looked like it looked to you like it ticked all the boxes. I mean, when you think about it, a therapist,
a doctor.
Exactly. That's what I was going to say. Yeah. A psychiatrist. Wow. Can also, you know, perhaps diagnose properly, give prescribed medication. So it looks like, and church going, which were all these things that look to you like this is it.
Right.
And so when you met him the first time, were there any red flags? Let's talk about that. Did you feel any red flags?
Yes, but I quickly minimized them and rationalize them. He was very kind of a goofy grandfather type. And so, the red flags that I felt, rather than seeing them as sinister, I saw he's being playful. He's joking around. He's trying to put you at ease. He's being silly. And so, you know, in that regard, it was a good cover that he had. Every red flag I saw, small or large, I saw independent from each other. So, you know, I didn't link anything together. So anytime there was something a little bit weird or made me feel a little bit uneasy, like when I saw him the very first session, he offered me an Afghan, but instead of just offering it to me to use, he kind of covered me up with it in a silly way. Well, it was very embarrassing, but I thought, oh, Amy, he's just trying to make an awkward situation less awkward. He's just trying to be silly, goofy, playful. And if you think about it, is that more likely, or is it more likely that he's a sociopath? It's probably more likely, we would think, right, that he's just goofing around and that we're oversensitive, we're overreacting. And so there were little, it was little things like that. And I would say the first big red flag was maybe 8 months into therapy, when he offered for a Christmas present to rub my shoulders or my feet. Now, I felt panic, like I just wanted to drop through an escape trap door and just get me out of the situation. But in my panic, I could just hear in my mind, just pick one, just pick one, just pick one. This is so uncomfortable. And, you know, sadly, no wasn't an option. Not really sure why it wasn't, or no, thank you, or neither. I think that our brains just assume that if this doctor and this therapist and this person 20 years my senior is offering this, that they wouldn't be offering it for a sinister or a bad reason. And if you're uncomfortable with it, it must stem from something in your past that makes you extra sensitive, extra. And, you know, kind of in my panic, I just wanted it to be done with. So I just made myself pick one. And I think I said shoulders. And then the minute he touched my shoulders, came over to my side of the office, I said feet or feet, just anything to get him back. And I forced myself to sit there and allow my therapist to rub my feet, acting as if this was totally normal. And it was horrifying. But I just couldn't grasp that he would be doing it for a bad reason. And I couldn't grasp that, you know, somebody like him who clearly had more value than I did, would be offering something that didn't make sense. And who was I as a person with lesser value to even criticize what he was offering or to question it? And I just thought, let's just get this over with. Let's just move on. This won't happen again. Christmas will pass. That's what's so tricky, is that you do not see a pattern. And once you get past each red flag, they're old news. They're old history. They're off your radar screen. So it wasn't until I got out of this abusive relationship about a year and a half into it that I was like, oh my gosh, I think this was connected. And I think it started then. No, it started back then. And so, yeah, that's what's so hard about it, is that you just don't understand that there's a process happening. And you don't understand how to think like a sociopath. You don't fathom in that moment, wait, is he trying to break down my boundaries and introduce touch so that he can slowly get closer to me and groom me? And you don't, why would your mind even go there? Like, he's a grandfatherly man on the prayer team. Weird, yes. Evil, I didn't think so. And, you know, my pastor trusted him, and my pastor was so intellectual, and I had other physicians. We live in a small town, and two of my doctors were close friends with him. And I just thought, he couldn't have passed all of their, you know, what's the word I'm looking for?
Radar? I don't know.
No. Yeah, he couldn't have cleared all of their radars, but mine is right and all of theirs is wrong. Right?
Yeah.
So yeah, that's what happens. We blow each thing off, or we decide it's us, and or it won't happen again. And
wow. You know, I'm listening and I'm thinking how much your story makes sense, you know, as a survivor. And I think wisdom and it makes sense as we get older. So like, I could see something like that happening to myself in my 20s. But, you know, as the decades have gone on and things I've learned, I can look back and say, well, that behavior, and I could speak up and I could say no. But back then, you know, we never had a voice, first of all, besides all the stuff he's doing and thinking he's a therapist and a professional and a whatever. Our own feelings and our own, this is uncomfortable. This is what we're used to, is bypassing everything we think and feel. And
yeah, that right was taken away from us when we were taken advantage of as children. Our right to have space, to exist, you know, was taken away, and we're knocked down so many rungs. Our value is so low that even when later in the relationship, when I thought he was hurting me, I thought, who am I to even call him on it? And who am I to turn him in? You know, just walk away. He helps other people. There's something wrong with you. But I wanted to say too, grooming is so tricky, because it has a negative connotation, and everybody thinks it's creepy and it's scary. But the thing is that grooming feels good. It's when the abuser is learning what your voids are, your weaknesses are, and then attempting to fill them. So for me, it was a father figure. And so he swooped in and played this supportive, caring, you know, kind, gentle father figure for me. And they don't make a big move until they know you they have you attached, till they know they have you hooked. So when I did mention that, you know, Christmas present thing, you're already, you don't want to lose the connection that you have. So you just kind of want, you know, to gloss that over and get that past, because it's like they're offering you a drug and you don't realize it. But once you've had a taste of it, you just need more, and you become so attached, and you just know you need whatever it is that they're offering. And I mean, every victim that I have ever spoken to, we all think that we were special and that we were unique. Even when we know there's other victims, we think, well, our relationship, it was different though. There was something special about it. It was kind of a pure connection, you know, or it was blessed by God, or it was just something that doesn't come around. And the thing is, it's a playbook they use. There's nothing special. There's nothing unique, but you have to know that when you're listening to the victim's stories, because when you hear a red flag and you're like, well, I would just leave. Well, you don't understand. You're too attached at that point. So to keep what you think you have, this illusion that they have created, this thing that you think you need, you're more willing to overlook red flags.
What you're saying is it was very thought out and planned.
Yes.
And so at the point that you feel attached, they recognize, okay, she's attached now. That makes so much sense what you're talking about. It was making me think of, you know, what we know about attachment, that we desperately need it as a child, and children will attach even if it's dangerous because we need it. And so that's what came to my mind when you were talking, because your attachment need, and you know, especially to a male figure, if you know, not have had can't speak, not having had that as a in a father figure, I could see that being like, you know, grabbing onto that. And it feels, you described it like a drug. I mean, it's just that connection that you always needed. And it just makes so much sense that, but what really gets me is, again, him as the professional, having all of that knowledge and using it for his benefit, or the his
sadistic pleasure. I you know, after I got out and I spoke with other victims and understood more, it was like he liked to trap people in psychological cages and then just toy with them, just torment them. It's sick and very sad. And I, like I said, I'd only maybe we were talking about this earlier, but I only saw this kind of evil like on TV or in movies, you know, and to see it up close is quite shocking. Your brain can't really wrap itself around it. So that's why you are more likely to minimize things or make excuses. At the very end, I could see the glimpses of evil coming through, the fact that this was all a joke, that, you know, there was no care or concern for me at all. And even then, I couldn't believe it. Even as I was seeing it, it took time, even after I left the relationship, to process it and realize that this is a dangerous man that needs to be stopped, that this is not, you know, a unique situation to you, or, you know.
I mean, your book has so many details of, you know, the way that the things that were happening, the experiences that were going on. And what was the period? Was it a year, 2 years? I can't remember.
That I saw him? I started seeing him in April of 2013 and I got out in July of 2014. So a year and a couple months.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it was a manipulation process that started on day one when he covered me up with that blanket. And I realized much later that was to invade my space right away just to get me comfortable with it.
Wow.
And he would hug me at church on Sundays just to make it clear to everyone around him that he's just a touchy-feely kind of guy. He's just an affectionate type person, so that if, you know, I spoke up or a victim spoke up, they would say, oh, he's just like that. You know, Dr. D, he's just like that. So yeah, it's really hard, but the first step in healing is to realize that you were never special. It was never special. In fact, it was a joke. And you were being toyed with like an object. That's really hard for survivors to let go of. But it's really key in realizing and letting go of the relationship. It really helped for me when another victim came forward and we were able to compare notes. And I was like, because even then I'd already gotten out. I knew he hurt me, but it still hurt my feelings when I realized he was saying the same exact things to her. Like, it's weird how that attachment is. It's like it lingers and it hopes that maybe there was something real there. Even when you intellectually know there wasn't, it takes a long time to emotionally admit that there wasn't. And I think it does stem from that childhood void, because those childhood voids are so critical in our development, or those childhood attachments, and they're powerful.
And yeah.
like you said, we'll hang on to them for dear life, even if they're hurting us, right? Because we need it. So it's very sad.
At first, when you were talking about how that, you know, realizing it's a joke, you have to, having to come to terms with that, I was like, But then as you explained more, I started realizing, yes, I see what she's saying, because of the attachment and it going back to the importance of, as a child or as a baby or we need to know that we are the light that shines in someone's eyes, that we are, you know, and he provided that for you. That's, I think, what right. You're really talking about. And again, we're talking, let's be realistic here. Yes, you were a woman, whatever, but I think it was coming from that child that never got that. That's the part that was struggling with even what somebody else, it's almost saying like my daddy, let's say, who is supposed to be my daddy. What? He's being a daddy to her? It doesn't make sense.
Yeah. And that's kind of the argument that I heard in my head while I was working with him. And I, in my book, I call it the inner critic, but it's like that child part is like willing to overlook anything. Right. And the adult part's like, I don't know, this is kind of weird, but that need that's being met is like, it's okay. We'll figure it out. We'll fix it.
Yeah.
Like, we need this. We can't survive without this. And, yeah, it's to heal, you know, from it. The reason you need to see that, you know, it was a joke, it meant nothing, is you've got to let go of that attachment, because you've got to find it somewhere else. You know, you've got to find it. For me, it was my faith, or find it in yourself. But severing that emotional tie is critical, because like when I reached out for help and didn't go to the next appointment, when I finally didn't go back, and my pastor and his wife sat with me during the 3-hour appointment slot, I knew then that the tie was cut, in the sense that I wasn't going to return. But the emotional attachment took months and months and months to heal. And that's where the real work begins, when, you know, you can finally admit that you didn't get that as a child. You didn't get that now. You're not going to get it, you know, from another human. I don't mean to say that God doesn't put people in our lives, but there's not going to be, you know, therapists, even good intention therapists, cannot be mom or dad. the cannot. And when they try, even I think with good intentions, the client can end up being hurt because it's just fostering a different dependency. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
Or yeah, kind of putting off the inevitable emotional work that needs to be done. You're just then clinging to something else.
Yeah. You know, you just reminded me of in one of my very early therapy sessions, I had this lady say, I was with CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy. She said something like, well, you don't have to worry. I will never like leave you or something to that effect. And that message was real. I, you know, that's what was one of my fears, of course, abandonment. And I was like, wow, I'm telling you, I don't know, maybe it was session six or something. She was like, you know, we can't work together anymore. I don't think I can give you what you need or something like that. And what was ringing in my head was this, you said you wouldn't leave, you know, and no concept of what she said and how that could impact a person who's had childhood trauma or abandonment. None.
Right.
I feel bad for that child that had to hear that because it was re-traumatizing. So
yeah.
Back to what you were saying. I hear that. And you know, it's interesting because on my journey of healing from trauma, childhood trauma, and it is a journey still on it. I think I'll be on it until what I see is that I don't, ex I maybe in my younger years, I was hoping to have like a mama mentor or something like that. And then I kind of realized it's not going to happen and that I would never be able to go back to my childhood or in the, as an adult, have a mama mentor or whatever. But what I've learned and experienced and am experiencing now is that we don't really need to go back to our childhood, but that those attachment needs can be met by safe friends or safe community. And not all of us have yet had that experience. And that's a good news because it's still possible. And not everybody is safe. And it takes time to recognize what is safety, what does safety feel like, you know, those kinds of things, even boundaries. But this is one of the things I've learned. You know, it's not always about a parent that's going to save you or anything like that. What was missing for us was, I always say this, two things. One, somebody with us in an experience that was so painful. And second, the witness to our pain. And safe friends can give that. They don't have to rescue us. They just have to be there with their presence so that we feel in our bodies that there's someone on the other end of the line. There's someone there. And that can meet an attachment need, I feel. Not the same as parenting, but as an adult, it's really helped me because that was missing in my attachment growing up, that I didn't feel connection, safe connection
right.
by either parents.
Yeah, I agree. And I like that you said community because I think what's so dangerous, especially in these therapist abusive, intentionally abusive therapist relationships, even like with yours, that's abusive to make a claim like that, that you cannot, you know, hold, you know, withhold, or am I saying that right? To look for that need in one person is dangerous. And to feel like you're getting that need met in one person, it becomes very powerful and all consuming. And when that happens, and other people and experiences in your life start to kind of fall away because this one relationship is becoming so crucial, that is really dangerous and a big red flag. We want to make sure, and it's okay to have, you know, like one close friend, I'm not saying that, but we need to be getting our needs met from a variety of people. That is what is healthiest and safest. You get into dangerous waters when it becomes one person, because, you know, even if that one person, like the therapist, I've seen therapists who they're so loving and they think that they're healing, offering healing when they play this mother role. But what if they pass away or, you know, they retire? I mean, it's setting the person up for so much repeat betrayal and trauma. So keeping connected to a community is something I always say is good just in general. You know, you don't want to have one anchor.
That is such a good, I've never heard anybody, Amy, phrase it that way. And that is such an important and good part because yes, we are, it's not that we're clingy, but because we are, it's a need that we that hasn't been met. So we crave and we cling and we want, but you're so right. Community is so important, a variety.
Because, you know, my world got so small that I was just sharing with my abuser. Now the abuser had a role in isolating me. He abusers will try to isolate you. So it was not all on me, but my world became him and my mentor who recommended him. And so when I went to her, you know, with red flags, she took his side. And then I just kind of like gave up inside, like, okay, well, I'll just figure this out on my own. My world was so small and it was so dangerous. And I like tell victims in these situations, you have to tell and keep telling until someone hears you, because what if the first one or two people you go to, either they're not as healthy as you are even, or maybe they have an allegiance to the abuser. So it's that community and keeping multiple connections that I think keeps us safe. Because you can't control if you go to a therapist that ends up being abusive. You know, there's really no way to prevent that from happening. Really, one of the only ways that we can keep ourselves safe is to have a community around us. And I had two people. So I was essentially living on an island, in an unhealthy island.
Mm-hmm. So. Yeah, that's a really, really good point. Wow. So interesting. Again, I want to show the book. It was so, so good. Preyed Upon. I think you're going to help a lot of people feel understood. I mean, even the way you talk, you have so much compassion and understanding and softness, which people really need, I think, after this experience. And I'm sure, you know, it can range. Your experience was pretty extreme. But even if people are sensing something, even listening to you and maybe now they'll reconsider listening to some of those warning signs, can be really, really helpful.
Yeah, and it's very hard to escape on your own. I think it's next to impossible to escape an abuser on your own, thus the need for the community. You've got to have that outside support and able to get away. And even when you do get away, you need that support to keep you from going back, because they will guilt you. They will, you know, I felt pity for mine. I felt guilty for abandoning him. He made me feel like he couldn't, that it would devastate him if I left. So I was feeling responsible for him. So again, I'm kind of going off on a tangent.
That's a really good point. I mean, again, he knows that, we know that too, that could be one of our issues, you know.
Like in my situation, he spent a year building this prison for me, right? You can't just walk out. You know, it's important to have these things set up before you try to leave. You need to have someone who believes you, first of all, as to what's going on. And then you need the support, because like I needed someone to physically sit with me during that 3-hour session because I knew I would cave. The doctor called 9 times. I could hear this. He left voicemails. We didn't answer. And I could hear the sadness in his voice and I could feel myself caving. And so it's just really important to have that support. And then when you're healing, to know that you're not alone, because that's all I wanted to know in the early days. Just please tell me I'm not the only person on the planet that is this gullible or whatever, you know, naive or horrible thing I was saying about myself. I just need to know that. And it was just like a lifeline that kept my head above water in the early days to know, nope, you're not alone. And it took time, but then I could see, well, if it happened to these people, and these people are intelligent, you know, kind, wonderful people, then it could happen to me, right? And maybe it isn't about me. And then you start to see that it isn't your fault. So
So what happened? Maybe you can tell us a little bit of justice here. Tell us what happened.
Yeah, I told my pastor. My pastor's wife wasn't hearing me, and I eventually told my pastor, and they sat with me during that 3-hour session, and I did not ever go back. He confronted him and had him step down as elder. And at that point, I was in my healing. I was like, it's just about me. It's something weird about me. Just leave him be. Just help me get out. I just want to get out. And I don't want to tell anybody on the planet that this happened to me. I'm so embarrassed and I'm so ashamed. And then in time, I grew the confidence to report to the medical board. And the medical board was very respectful and compassionate. I did not expect that. And they ended up allowing the doctor to surrender his medical license permanently in my state. That was a small victory, that at least he, you know, I stopped him from hurting other people currently and in the future. And then I wanted more. And I was told that because therapist abuse is not illegal in my state, criminally illegal, that if I pursued criminal charges, that it would be brutal for me and my family and that he would likely walk. So I decided to pursue a civil malpractice suit. And that took 3 years and was not without its stressors, but it felt really good to fight for myself because I'd never done that my entire life, ever. And then to feel that other people that I didn't even know wanted to fight for me, it was just so healing, you know? And you know, I never had a brother, but I always wanted a big brother who would beat up people for me. And having a compassionate attorney, now you have to go to one that understands abusive power. You cannot reach out to one who does not, or they will further traumatize you.
Could you repeat that, please? Because I know people who have had not. Okay, repeat that.
If you decide to pursue any kind of civil or criminal charges, you should reach out to an attorney. Do not reach out to attorney unless you know that they are trained in my case, therapist and clergy abuse or abuse of power. If they don't understand that dynamic, you will be further traumatized. They will question you, mock you, ask you why you went back. They have no understanding of it. And it almost made me give up. The organization Tell that I mentioned earlier hooked me up with my attorney. And now there are many, many good ones in the country. I have some on my website, but you need to start there. And you need to understand that what you do next is totally up to you. You do not owe anyone anything. You do not owe society the justice. It does not have to fall on your shoulders. There's people that want to walk away and be done with it, and that is okay. There's people that want to report to the licensing boards, and that is okay. Criminal charges, it's what is best for you and your healing. Because it's already unfair how adult victims get blamed, but then I feel like they have the added responsibility of coming forward, even though we're going to be attacked and mocked for coming forward. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. It makes sense.
It isn't our responsibility to stop any sociopath. We are not bad people if we choose not to do that, if we choose to go on about our healing and leave it alone, because it is stressful. For me, it was good. I felt good fighting despite the stress. For me, I needed that. I guess I'd just like people to know that you're not failing society if you decide to do nothing. It's perfectly acceptable.
Thank you for that. Thank you for that. Wow, this was powerful. And I'm so glad that you got to feel empowered. I'm glad that you had a team on your side and that you felt it. You felt it in your body and that you're continuing to heal. There's been so much healing, but as we know, we're continuing all the time to heal and find safe connection. So is there anything else that you want to say just before we end, or are you good on this?
There's one thing I want to say that was so healing for me. And that was soon after my abuse, I decided to tell my husband everything because I'm just an honest person and I felt like I should. And was still confused on what I was to blame for and what I wasn't to blame for at that stage. And I got to speak with a psychologist who specializes in therapist and clergy abuse. And he said, "Did you tell your husband?" And I said, "Yes, I told him everything." And he said, "Well, that's a shame, because what I do in these situations is I sit down with the couples and I explain to the spouse that your wife, I'm just going to say wife because it's typically the woman getting taken advantage of, that your wife was a victim of a crime. And do victims of crimes owe explanations to anyone about what happened to them? Absolutely not." And I just felt tears coming down my face, because he was giving me permission to see myself as a victim that I was.
A victim of crime.
But the rest of the world wasn't going to give me that pass. And I knew it. And that's, as an adult, when you come forward, you know you're going into it. Victims of sexual assault, especially, if they come forward, they feel they owe an explanation or that they have to defend themselves. We don't expect that from any other crime victims. It's ridiculous.
True.
Ridiculous. And I also like to say that you cannot be both a victim and a crime. I mean, you cannot be both a victim and a participant in a crime committed against you. It's ridiculous. Mm-hmm. No. And sexual assault victims just need to hear that, because we don't hear that message very often.
Oh, I'm so glad. And what a wonderful psychologist.
I know, it was wonderful.
Great. Well, thank you for sharing that.
Yeah.
So I will put the link to your book as well as your website, if people want to find out more about you. And I really, really appreciate you writing the book and sharing with the audience your story.
Thank you.
88% of the work week is spent communicating, so it's important your team does it well. Enter Grammarly. Grammarly's AI helps teams communicate clearly the first time. It shows you how to make words resonate with your audience, helps with brainstorming, and lets you instantly create and revise drafts in just one click. Join over 70,000 teams and 30 million people who use Grammarly to move work forward. Go to grammarly.com/enterprise to learn more. Grammarly, enterprise ready AI.